The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Bugler! Thought I'd make it a bit more personal this week. That greeting was for you. Yes, you, and you alone. Welcome to issue 121 of The Bugle, 121 of the world's only legal podcast for the week beginning Monday, the 5th of July, 2010, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in the city that has now not burned down for almost 344 years in a row, London, and across the Atlantic, up a bit more, no, down a bit, back up a bit, down a tiny bit. There he is, in New York City, clocking in at a piss-poor 174 years since his last great fire. It's the man who once threatened to hit Richard Nixon in the face with a tennis racket. Oh no, hang on, that was Australian tennis legend Ken Rosewall. Oh no, hang on, he never did that. But he must have thought about it. Anyway, it's John Oliver!
Hello, Andy! Hello, Buglers! Andy, I hosted a charity awards ceremony this week.
Right, born to do it, mate. I always thought you were very much an awards host ahead of anything else.
You know, but I have a good tone for it. You know, I respect awards.
Really?
You know, I like the fact they're distributed.
Yeah.
It was a Radio City musical for a national voluntary organisation. So actually, quite an incredibly worthwhile group of people, from 9/11 first responders to civil rights activists and incredibly driven and selfless young people. It was a genuine honour to be there, but the opening to the gig was a little overblown, Andy. Let me describe it to you. It started with a Taiwanese drum band who then slowly descended through the front of the hydraulic stage. The curtains were pulled back and I stepped through. And I'm not sure there's ever been a bigger anti-climax in that venue than at that moment. All that razzmatazz culminating in a bespectacled Englishman walking out in a grey suit, looking like he's about to talk to everyone about their taxes. They have the Rockettes, Andy, at Radio City. They have Santa Claus on that stage. I could feel a tangible suction of disappointment from the walls themselves. And there was one point, after awards had been given out to various children from 10 to 14 years old, who had independently set up numerous organisations, from writing letters to veterans to helping build homes for those devastated by natural disasters, that I had to go out on stage and introduce the next award. And people were very moved, understandably, by what they'd seen and heard. Some people were audibly crying. It's hard to know how to set the right tone, Andy. I found myself saying out loud, I don't want anyone to go away from here with the impression that my childhood was without achievement. When I was a kid, for instance, I once fit 12 grapes in my mouth. So sometimes your mouth works faster than your brain, Andy.
Yeah.
That's a clear design flaw of the human body. God or Captain Evolution has a lot to answer for.
The week beginning Monday, the 5th of July 2010, that means it's 56 years, John, since the BBC launched a daily TV news programme for the first time. Previously, if anything happened on a non-news day, it wasn't reported and would therefore generally go unnoticed by the public. And events that have since come to light that no one knew about at the time include Franklin Roosevelt meeting Winston Churchill's youngest daughter at the Yalta Conference in 1945 and saying, "Rooty tooty lemon fruity, hot dog and a sesame bap, if I was 5 years younger." Sorry, fellas, right, post-war Europe. One, two, three, and scissors. Ah, Joey boy, scissors beat stone. We get Czechoslovakia, double or quits. That never came out, fell on the wrong day. The Anglo-Portuguese War of 1948-52, the outbreak of hostilities caused when a Portuguese waiter dropped a custard tart on Clement Attlee's head at Nye Bevan's birthday party weekend on the Algarve.
He couldn't let that go.
Well, no, it was missed by the news, and the entire war consequently went unreported. Fighting was fierce and intense, both on the southern front, as British troops attempted to capture the famous Casa Pastéis de Belém, the spiritual home of the custard tart just outside Lisbon, both to cut off supplies of the unfeasibly delicious little snacks and to inflict a grievous blow on Portuguese national morale, and also fierce fighting in the Portuguese counteroffensive on the beaches of Skegness in Lincolnshire. Both sides suffered massive casualties, but the media never quite get an angle on it like they had with the goodies v baddies World War II shtick, and no one in Britain ever found out, until now. And also unreported was that Princess Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth II as she now is, once went on a date with Clark Gable, who was many years her senior, but Gable was in Britain during the war working for the Inland Revenue as a freelance Robin Hood on a series of daring robberies from the rich to give to the state, or tax collections as they were called at the time. Anyway, he broke into Buckingham Palace to try to pinch enough loot to cover an unpaid corporation tax bill, when he bumped into the teenage princess playing cops and robbers with some random descendant of the last Tsar. Cable said Bagsy'd be a robber. The two clicked and went on a secret date, a day trip to France. Sadly, the date they chose was the 6th of June 1944. And their romantic stroll along a secluded Normandy beach was rudely interrupted by the D-Day landings. "Do you want to take a rain check on this?" said the superstitious Gable, who was allergic to bullets. The Queen replied, "What was that, pet?" whilst repeatedly punching a German machine gunner in the face. Gable was gobsmacked, as was the German machine gunner, literally. The German said, "Eins, zwei, Clark Gable, can I have your autograph?" "Sure, who shall I make it out to?" said Gable. "Sebastian, how is the undercover work going?" "What the f***?" said the Queen. "Oh, shit," said Gable. "Laura the Stag? Don't try that shit on me, big dog," hit back the future Queen, grabbing Gable in a headlock. Or should I say, grosser hund? The Queen spanned the discombobulated film star on her hand like a basketball, then slam-dunked him into a panzer tank. "Look, I don't think this is really working out," said Gable. "You're just not my kind of girl." "Damn straight I'm not," said the future Queen. "And if you thought telling me that Friar Tuck was a spoonerism was going to get you into my royal underpantaloons, you're not my kind of guy either. See ya, wouldn't want to be ya." The Queen moonwalked across the beach and tried to catch a lift back to Britain. "Can I get your number?" shouted Gable, out of habit more than expectation. But the future monarch was gone. "Friar Tuck? Friar Tuck?" she whispered to herself. "How dare he? I don't care how good he looks in green leggings. How dare he?"
Top story this week, I spy with my little eye something beginning with bullshit. Andy, there are only three things better than stories about spies. They are ice cream, the release of Nelson Mandela, and Lionel Messi. And those three have had a relatively quiet week this week, so it's spy stories that have dominated the news. The FBI have arrested 11 people suspected of being Russian spies who have been living in the United States under deep cover since the 1990s, a time when even then spying was slightly old-fashioned and ridiculous. Well, it turns out they've been in the US ever since, doing essentially very little. In fact, a Russian security analyst pointed out this week that the alleged spy ring doesn't seem to have really done any spying. He said they haven't managed to gather any kind of significant information and didn't have any kind of sources worth noticing. Most stuff they transmitted, if indeed they did transmit it, could have been lifted from the New York Times website. In fact, they've done so little that none of the people accused in this case have been charged with espionage, only with not registering as representatives of a foreign government and money laundering. And I really hope that they were just lifting articles from the New York Times, Andy. It would be fantastic. It's the equivalent of cheating on an exam, just cutting and pasting text into a document, maybe changing some of the sentences around. I've completely cracked this whole spying game, Dimitri. You just need a premium pass to newyorktimes.com. I could get all my spying out of the way in about 45 minutes and I'd spend the rest of the day playing Frisbee with myself. Honestly, I do most of my spying now, and I do not exaggerate, Dimitri. I do most of my spying while having my morning dump. I'm not even joking. I'm telling you, you're working too hard. And this also means that whoever's been writing those articles in the New York Times has technically been spying for the Russians, Andy. So I want to see nothing short of Frank Rich being led out of the offices in handcuffs and sent straight to Guantanamo to answer some very nasty questions.
Well, it's also, I mean, the challenge has really gone for spies ever since the US Department of Defense started up its own Twitter feed, which has included recently entries such as "Busy day, moving three warheads to a new location in Nevada. Need to get done by three to catch the Angels-Dodgers game." But it's untrue to say they didn't find out anything. Apparently one couple had told Moscow that they discovered that America is a society, quotes, that values home ownership.
Yes.
And
yes,
there must have been some old telephone operator at KGB HQ in Moscow saying, "Holy f***ing Lenin, we have really lost our edge. What else? Do they like milkshakes and burgers?" Do you not get a part in one of your next films? Is there a Russian...
Slightly Russian too band? Good, Andy.
Right.
That's slightly too good. I mean, that's a rock-solid Russian accent.
I'll put in a word for me, mate.
The spies were apparently living in New Jersey, which is not so much deep undercover, Andy, as subterranean undercover. If they're hoping to pick up casual information from talking to their neighbours, the only thing they're going to learn there is whatever gossip is coming out of the New York Jets training camp. I do hope that Moscow is interested in finding out whether or not LaDainian Tomlinson is going to be used more in a wide receiver role than in the traditional running back position he had at the Chargers.
Isn't that the American is from New Jersey as well, isn't he?
So he is, that's right.
Ask some questions about his provenance and motives.
Well, let's ask next time he comes in, Andy, let's ask him.
Yeah, I think we should. I was quite intrigued by Miss Chapman, who was apparently, you know, the young woman who was painted by some in the press as a femme fatale of aspiring. Although if the aspiring is really just finding out stuff off the internet, I don't know how fatale a femme can be. And also, she didn't really indulge in classic spy behaviour, posting glamorous photos of herself on a Facebook page. Yeah. Which isn't really maintaining a low profile, is it?
Well, also, it just shows how seriously the media are taking it. That most of the discussion this week here has been whether or not she was attractive or not.
Oh, right.
That seems to really split people right down the middle.
Really?
So it's good to know that people are focusing on the most important things here.
And what's the consensus then?
Well, there is no consensus yet.
Right, I see. I mean, has it split on Republican Democrat lines?
It's not so much. I think there's a standard acceptance that she's quite attractive, but it's whether she's smoking hot or just quite hot.
Right.
So that's driving people apart. It's basically one step down from the abortion issue here.
Right, I see. And has it supplanted healthcare, do you think?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's no way Obama's going to touch it, but he's going to be asked.
Right.
He's going to be asked, so he better have an answer ready.
Well, I mean, shouldn't he be all over this, really? I mean, shouldn't he by now have either taken her on a date or said absolutely no way? Surely he's got to go one way or the other, hasn't he?
Come on, just stop sitting on the fence.
But what do you think, John, more importantly?
She seems fine, Andy. Seems fine, yeah.
That sounds like a Republican talking. You've changed.
As well as using modern technology, the FBI caught them also using more traditional techniques.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Andy. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to get that now?
Yeah, okay, I will. Yeah. Charlie. I'm just recording the bugle now. This is
bad timing, Charlie. Bad timing.
I'll call you later. Sorry, mate. Sorry.
Oh, you're talking to me, Andy?
Yeah.
Talking to f***ing Charlie? Who's Charlie, Andy? So, yeah, the FBI also found them using more traditional spying techniques, such as invisible ink. Is that really a spying technique, Andy, or something stolen from one of their 11-year-old daughter's diary stationery?
Apparently, write in milk and then put it in the oven. That's what I learned as a kid.
What? Hold on.
You write on paper with milk, and then you put it in the oven, and then
and
the lettuce
comes. Cook the paper?
Yeah, well, you cook the milk essentially.
Right.
And then you can.
And you, you don't want to overcook the paper, then, otherwise the message is gone.
Yeah.
So is that basically an early cooking technique?
I think that's how cheese was discovered. Just forgetful spies leaving notes out in the open.
Apparently, they also buried money next to a beer bottle marker and conducted brush pasts in parks where agents swap identical bags as they pass each other. Are we absolutely sure that these are actual spies, Andy, not just John le Carré novel nerds at a fan convention? The reaction to this news was instantaneous. Putin said that the US police had let themselves go and were putting people in prison. Not exactly sure what he means there, and is he concerned that Russian citizens are being jailed by police in America that are obese? Does he think US law enforcement has let itself go through dealing with self-esteem issues by just running to the fridge? That's pretty blunt criticism about their weight from Putin. I think Petraeus might have something to say about that in his next interview with a teen magazine. Details about the spies as individuals have been emerging all week, partly due to the fact that, as you mentioned, they seem to think that Deep Undercover also includes having Facebook pages with uploaded photos of them drinking at a party in a Bill Clinton mask. Neighbours of one pair of spies said that Cynthia was a financial consultant who commuted to Manhattan, while Richard Murphy was a stay-at-home father who, and I quote, seemed kind of lazy. I have to say, Andy, I love the idea of a lazy James Bond. I think the next Bond movie should definitely move in that direction. Get rid of Daniel Craig. He's too driven. Replace him with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'd like to see Bond falling asleep at a casino table or failing to be at a rendezvous point in time because he stopped off for a hot dog and now has mustard down the front of his cheap tuxedo.
But you haven't seen the director's cut of Goldfinger.
Also, these particular spies were basically self-sufficient, receiving relatively little financial support from the Russian government. One was a financial planner with an annual income of $135,000, and another, Anna Chapman, who you mentioned, owned her own real estate firm in Manhattan, valued at around $2 million. That's even better, Andy. That's Bond with a job. That could make for some very interesting scenes with M. Bond, we need you to go to Paraguay to assassinate a rebel leader who has a British secret he's attempting to sell to the Middle East. Sure, sounds good. It's going to be a little tricky to book the time off work. I've used up all my vacation days at the moment. I've also been working on the Anderson account, which is huge for me. I'll badly need to have that proposal on my boss's desk by the end of next week. There's a big promotion lined up. Couldn't I go to Paraguay sometime in late November? Hold on, scratch that. We have a work picnic that we all have to go to. I can't do that. Bond, this is very important. Sure, I accept that. It's just I can't call in sick like last month when I took out that Mexican drug cartel for you. My supervisor flat out told me he thought I was faking lupus. All right, Bond, get out of here. Another spy was described as clumsy and quirky, but highly intelligent. Pretty much just super socially awkward. He always said weird jokes that no one really got. Okay, that's it. That is better still. A socially awkward Bond, Andy. That's the Bond I want to see next. A Bond who starts sweating horribly and comes out in hives whenever attractive women are around. A Bond who angrily corrects villains who happen to misquote passages from The Hobbit. And a Bond who has an asthma inhaler with him at all times.
So, I guess what this has shown, John, is that we just don't know who is a spy these days and who isn't. And I'm pretty sure some of these people didn't even realise they were spying. And I think the time has come now to do an official Bugle, are you a spy, test.
Okay.
Okay, so here's the question. You can all test, Buglers. You can all see if you might be a spy. So there's three questions. When you wake up in the morning, do you A, think to yourself, oh, it's good to be alive, so much to look forward to, breakfast, lunch, tea time snack, dinner, and the rest, yummy yum. Or do you B, think to yourself, I must make an extra special effort today to blend in seamlessly to my local community. Question two, when you find out something interesting, do you A, go straight onto a social networking site and post something about it, then gossip about it with your friends, or do you B, keep it under your hat until you get a few quiet moments when you can call a secret office in downtown Moscow on a secure line? And finally, question three, when in conversation with a government official at a drinks party, do you A, assume he or she wants to steer clear of official business and make conversation about sports or films or sport in films or how to film sport? Or do you B, start plying him with drinks and shifting the conversation onto classified subjects like whether America is planning military action on Australia for their overthrow of an elected prime minister and imposition of an unelected replacement, whilst trying to build up a rapport so that when you put your arm around his shoulder later in the evening, he'll think you're just being his buddy rather than trying to plant an electronic bug underneath his collar? So, if it's mostly A's, you're probably in the clear. Mostly B's. Das verdanya, kamerad.
The spies also made a number of slapstick-style mistakes, Andy. Two of the alleged agents organised a drop-off at a park in Arlington in which one placed $5,000 in cash in an envelope hidden in a folded newspaper and left it for collection by the other. The package was intercepted by the FBI. So they lost that package, Andy. They lost that $5,000, but it gets even better. Another was observed going into a Verizon phone shop in Brooklyn, New York, buying a mobile phone and giving the shop staff an address, which was this, 99 Fake Street. Fake Street. They're not even f***ing trying, Andy.
It's almost like they wanted to be caught.
But these have actually been very reassuring times here in New York. First, we had a terrible terrorist who locked his house keys in the car that failed to detonate. Now, we have some terrible spies, too. The world is becoming a much simpler, more charming place, Andy, as it spews oil into its own oceans.
Well, on the subject of communists, Barack Obama news now. And, how far up does it go, John? It could the president himself be could in very deep cover. I mean,
could he be communist? I mean, yeah. Obviously a communist, Andy.
Or is he working directly
for
Moscow?
Ripping this country apart with socialism. I don't know. Right. Short of stamping a hammer and sickle on his forehead, I don't know what more he could do.
Well, it's possible that Putin could also be CIA.
Oh, boy.
I mean, we just don't know. We just don't know anymore.
I mean, we can be fairly sure, but not 100% sure.
But Obama has been criticised this week for playing too much golf, during particularly while the oil spills into the Gulf of Mexico. I guess he might say in his defence that he was trying to hit golf balls into the sea to soak up the naughty oil. That seems to be what golf balls are generally used for these days. But I guess you'll have to ask, is it such a problem, John? Because surely golf is the kind of game where you can make some massive policy decisions while you play. It's not like boxing in that respect. You know, I know when I play golf, I make huge international policy decisions. It's just I don't really have the forum to put them into action afterwards. But it certainly has affected my golf game. And in fact, we've just recovered this commentary on Obama playing golf from Fox News.
Oh, yeah.
Because they cover his golf, I think, have an exclusive contract. So over to Mike at the 13th. Thanks, Tony. And the president's in trouble here. Trying a delicate fade to give him the best line into the pin, but he's just sliced it a bit and found some nasty rough. Had to play there with a soft touch. So looking at his foreign policy, you'd have thought he'd be pretty good at it. But I guess that's what happens when you sacrifice the foundations of American society on the altar of left-wing dogma. You end up in a real mess anyway. Looks like he's going with a 5-iron. I think he's going to take a cut at the green here. A brave golf shot from the president, and made more difficult, I would imagine, by the nagging thought that he's making America an international laughingstock with his bleeding-heart liberal attitudes to the environment, terrorism and shit like that. Must be hard to focus on the shot for the young Kenyan. Still, I guess he thinks he's got Allah on his side, and that's going to give him some confidence. Oh, no, he's put the 5-iron back in the bag, and he's going to play safe with the wedge. Typical backsliding from Obama there. He shaped up to do something really bold, and he's chickened out and taken the safest option. Typical communist golf shot from a typical communist golfer.
Apparently, Obama has played at least 7 times since the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded on the 20th of April. Ask you over this, Annie. How many times have sea turtles played golf in that time? Yeah? How many times have sea turtles played golf? I guess it's, you know, hard to say exactly, but it's probably less than 7.
Yep.
And that's something Obama really should be thinking about. But just to put this in perspective...
To be fair, John, the sea turtles have played water polo quite a lot.
Well, it's not. No one's criticising Obama for playing water polo. This is a golf issue.
Okay.
And to put it in perspective, if we're this angry with the president, Andy, if people are this furious, where is public opinion going to go with Ernie Els? That guy's been out playing golf almost non-stop since the leak began. Is that any way to respond to a crisis on this scale? And don't think that American Phil Mickelson's constant presence on the PGA circuit has gone unnoticed either. It's disgusting, Andy. The way he's playing is like he's celebrating Louisiana being ruined again. Need I remind you that Phil played right through the relief effort for Hurricane Katrina too? He makes me sick.
Well, I guess he would say that, given that he played golf before, he had to keep on playing golf, otherwise he'd have backed down and the terrorists would have won.
Right.
Was it terrorists who did Katrina? I can't remember.
Well, it was BP. Right. So, yeah, I mean, yes and no.
Also in Obama news, him and David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, have shared a beer. Well, they swapped beers. They were settling a bet made before the World Cup match between de facto champions England and the rightly eliminated USA. but because, in Obama's words, the match ended in a tie, with all due respect, Mr. Obama, it did not. It ended in a draw. It's football. He's mixing it up with a stripper at a hen party. That ends in a tie, I've heard. But anyway, so they gave each other... They gave each other a beer, and Obama gave Cameron Goose Island 312 from Chicago, and advised Cameron to refrigerate his beer. And I guess Cameron is used to putting things in the refrigerator, the entire British economy and public sector, for example.
Boom!
Kabam!
Boom!
Boom! Take that! Take that, the system! Then Cameron offered Obama a bottle of Hobgoblin Real Ale from a local brewery in his constituency. And Obama said, I'm happy to give that a shot, although I will not drink it warm. And Cameron replied, you can have it cold, it's all right. He caved, John. He caved.
That's it.
That beer is supposed to be drunk warm. Cameron has let Obama ride roughshod over a fundamental part of British culture.
America's lapdog, Andy. God. When is someone going to have the strength of mind and the confidence to stand up to an American president and say, do you know what? F*** you. It's supposed to be cold, you f***. And before slowly and confidently walking out of that room. God, that would be, what a moment for Britain that would be.
Well, yeah, I think we need Cameron to show some leadership, John. And he should have stood up to Obama, as you say, and said, "What, mate, you will drink it warm, and what's more, you will enjoy it warm, or you will reap the consequences. Global symbol of social progress and racial integration, or no global symbol of social progress and racial integration. If the French president gave you the Mona Lisa from the Louvre to settle a bet on a boxing match between Mike Tyson and Vanessa Paradis, you wouldn't look at it with sunglasses on, would you? Have some respect. If the Spanish king Juan Carlos settled a bet on the long-awaited Pittsburgh Steelers against the Escuela de Niños de Pontevedra gridiron game by giving you a leg of the finest ham on Iberico, you wouldn't say, yeah, well, I'll tell you how I like legs, with fishnet stockings and suspenders." He should have stood up, John. In fact, well, also, you say, Cameron points out, it's 5.2%, the Hobgoblin. This was a bit of a challenge because, of course, the Goose Island 312 was only 4.2% alcohol. So he was effectively saying to Obama, "You, sir, are a fruit juice drinking pussy." And if Obama had really wanted to stamp his authority on the special relationship at this early stage of his administration, he would have taken Obama's bottle of Goose Island 312, he would have cracked the lid off with his teeth, he would have eyeballed Obama, he would have glugged it down in one, he would have smiled at Obama, then he would have opened his mouth and belched the Star Spangled Banner. And then he would have said, "Your go, 3, 2, 1, and down it!" Bang! Instant respect, instant control of the relationship.
King Tut's Wang news now. And listen, Andy, Time magazine has had some spectacular headlines over the years.
Yep.
And the only one's denying that. They're an award-winning periodical. But have they ever produced a better one than this? Is King Tut's penis missing? They're just posing the question, Andy. Like any good journalist, is it missing? And shouldn't we collectively really have an answer for that? Apparently, the king's genitalia was attached to the mummy during its first unwrapping in 1922, meaning that the post-mortem castration likely occurred in modern times. Now, who was it who had to make that awkward confirmation, Andy? All right, lads, can anyone confirm that King Tut's penis was attached to his body in 1922? Yeah, I can definitely do that. Okay. All right. Well, that's great news, Harry. However, I now have a critical follow-up question. How is it that you know that, Harry?
Apparently, this report also claimed other things about Egypt, including that mummification began as an extreme form of contraception, that the Sphinx was originally a breakup sculpture, and a pretty bitchy one at that. The ancient Egyptian equivalent of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. Also, that the pyramids were originally built as a stadium for the ancient Egyptian sport of baby rafting, in which infants of slaves were put into wicker rafts or baskets, chucked into the Nile, and the last one eaten by a crocodile won. And Moses was awesome at it, John. Awesome. That's probably the sport that Jews have been best at historically.
That is true.
So, as you say, the reports have suggested that the Wang went missing sometime between 1922, when King Tut's remains were found, and 1968. And I have found out, after some investigation, that it did circulate on the black market for a while, undergoing a long journey far from its original home, a pineid, if you will. And among the rumoured sightings of the Pharaoh's Frabbler were in 1972, Fidel Castro was photographed celebrating re-electing himself as King of Cuba by smoking a small, shrivelled-looking cigar. "Is that a new make of cigar, Fidel?" asked his PA, Jeanette. "Yes, Jeanette, it's called Tutankhamun's penis. I can't get it to stay alight." Oh, bollocks. "Nip out and buy me a tin of Café Crème's Love and a bag of jelly babies. And make sure there are a lot of red ones in it. I'm feeling communist." "Righto, FC. Don't call me that, Jeanette. Don't. You know I don't like it. I'm just never sure exactly what it's supposed to stand for, particularly not when the Americans call me it." In 1979, subsequently, Soviet ace Leonid Brezhnev signed the SALT II Treaty using Tutankhamun's little old prango. He'd acquired it from funk legend Sly Stone at a groove convention in Novosibirsk the year before, and thought that if he signed the treaty with a 2,300-year-old willy, it would not be legally binding. And the Boy King's much sought-after Eaglop next surfaced at the 1993 Super Bowl, when legendary Dallas Cowboys running back Emmitt Smith scored a fourth-quarter touchdown, and celebrated by pretending to unwrap some Egyptian-style mummification bandages, then pulling King Tut's patat out of his sock, putting it on his upper lip like a moustache, and prancing around pretending to be Salvador Dali.
What a celebration.
The NFL later banned any celebrations using irreplaceable archaeological artefacts. And in fact, just last year, New England Patriots wide receiver Wes Welker was banned for one match for celebrating a touchdown by sacrificing a bull with an ancient Greek sword that once belonged to King Agamemnon of Mycenae. There are also unconfirmed rumours that Marlene Dietrich was found dead in 1992, clutching Tutankhamun's little crankle in her left hand, with a fresh tattoo of the Boy King on her buttock, and a diary full of covert references to romantic days out with Tootsie.
Feature section now! Still the World Cup! Still the World Cup, Andy, although, to be honest, it definitely feels like it's slightly less the World Cup than it was this time last week.
I know.
What a disaster.
Well, it's easy to think as the World Cup ticks around towards its end next Sunday that a gaping chasm of nothingness is looming for the next 4 years, devoid of hope, devoid of joy and devoid of love. Sorry, I must stop quoting George Osborne's latest statements on the economy. Boom!
Boom again! Wow.
But still...
You're working with the heavy bag this week,
right,
Andy.
I am. By next Sunday evening, there's going to be no World Cup until June 2014.
Oh, that's what a horrible, horrible thought that is.
Well, I think that puts everything else in perspective, John.
I don't know how you took England's loss, Andy, but what I did to maintain my relationship was left almost immediately after the game and went out for a two-hour walk around Central Park. So let me say, if you happen to walk past me in Central Park during that time, then I apologise for whatever obscenity was spewing from my profoundly disappointed mouth.
Well, I don't know. I'd try to find a positive, John, because I think, despite being knocked out in a humiliating 4-1 defeat, I do think England are still in it, really, because, you know, we always bounce back, John. We're a tough nation.
Yeah.
Never say die attitudes. Yeah, I mean, we're never more dangerous than when we've just been eliminated.
That's true.
I mean, this is the last chance for a lot of these players getting on a bit the wrong side of 30. So we know they won't take this defeat lying down. And so I think they're going to bounce back strongly in the quarter-final that they're not actually allowed to play in. But on paper, the thing is, on paper, we still have the best team in the tournament. That, I believe all the pundits.
You're right. Our
players are still the best in the universe.
You're right, Andy. Come on, England!
Despite all the evidence.
Yeah.
It's kind of bizarre, this insistence that England's players were so good that individually they were better than almost all the Germans. I guess it was a bit like when you're a kid, you say that Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet was unquestionably the greatest album of all time. And this is purely hypothetical, of course. I'm not saying I was or knew a kid that said that. But of all time, Slippery When Wet, someone might say, well, have you heard Exile on Main Street? No. Have you heard Blood on the Tracks? Nah. Have you heard Pet Sounds? Is that by Bon Jovi? No. Then, no. Sure. Slippery When Wet is a very good album, John, but at the highest level, its flaws may be exposed. One or two world-class songs, but some real padding, too. I mean, Social Disease, for example, that is an out-of-form Aaron Lennon of a track.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Your emails now, and, well, this week, most of your emails have been sending us pictures of things that look like wangs, or are actually wangs.
It's a throwback.
Yeah. So, thanks for that. But this is an excellent email on the subject. The official bugle bird. Hello, John and Andy, the other guy and the ghost of Tom in order of relative smurfiness.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a problem. Last week I got a speeding ticket. I would really like to send the attached photo of me flipping the bird while there was a real live bird on my middle finger along with a speeding ticket. And he sent us these two pictures of him with a little bird with his middle finger outstretched, with an actual bird on his bird.
Yeah, I mean it's really something.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to believe that humanity has existed for this long without this happening before. But I'm not sure it has happened before.
He's pulled off the very tricky double bird.
Yeah,
and it's not easy.
Anyway, he carries on. But alas, I'm a little paranoid. The highway patrol might come snooping around. But I know I shouldn't, but I really want to. What should I do? Maybe you can give this out as the official bugle bird for people to print or send out for just such circumstances. FYFI, which I believe is an elaboration on for your information.
Yeah.
This photo was taken from Hurricane Ridge in the Olympic Mountains of Northwest Washington State. USA, yep. USA, yep. USA.
Well, it's beautiful.
Well, that's the land of the free, isn't it? You know, I mean, what other country in the world could have produced a beautiful landscape and a man flipping the bird with a bird on his middle finger?
That's the thing. It's quintessentially American, this image, Andy.
It's the land of opportunity, John.
It's about freedom of speech and how to abuse that. And that's what America has always been all about.
So that is from Martin Van Nostrand of Gig Harbor, Washington. And since our webpage is currently out of commission, I will try and use the Twitter feed to post this picture, if that is within my technological scope.
You don't have the skills for that, Andy.
Oh, yeah,
but
mate.
Good luck.
What, mate?
Yeah, good luck.
What, mate? You talk with the confidence of someone who reckons he does have the skills.
I reckon I'm more likely
to have the skills than you.
That's definitely true, but that's still not the required skills.
You haven't yet learned to sharpen a pencil. So do look out for it on the Bugle Twitter feed, at Hello Buglers.
You sharpen a pencil, Andy, by smacking it repeatedly against a stone wall.
Oh, right. That's just your solution for everything, John, which is why I'm not sure it's a good idea for you ever to have kids. So, Bugle Sport now, and, well, not much time for sports, because we've talked about Tutankhamun's penis for too long. But, we didn't have the option. This was a classic situation, John. You know, there's a story about Tutankhamun's penis. We basically had no choice.
You've got to put everything on hold.
Yeah, I mean, people say, well, you know, you've always got a choice. But, I mean, really, there was no choice.
No.
But the sport this week, well, Andy Murray is about to play his semi-final, as we record, against Rafael Nadal. So at the moment, he remains Britain's Andy Murray. Let's merge the sport with the forecast. By this time next week, will Britain have its first Wimbledon champion since the 1930s?
Or will Scotland have just the latest loser to play tennis?
Or will Rafael Nadal have become British?
That's my prediction, Andy.
Yep.
Nadal is going to see the light. And to convert to a British citizen, and he will never win another title again.
So come on, tennis. And more importantly, come on for a quick word, actually, as a tag on to our football section. There was the team of the World Cup for me, John, because, you know, it's been an up and down tournament. But for me, the unquestionable team of the World Cup, Honduras.
Yes.
Who did not score a goal in the entire tournament.
Doesn't matter.
But.
Doesn't matter.
In their last group game, they had to play Switzerland, who. Yeah. As we know, are the dullest team in the history of sport.
They are a shower of shit.
And if Honduras had lost that game 2-0, Switzerland would have gone through.
Yeah.
So Honduras went into that game knowing they had a responsibility to the entire planet to knock Switzerland out.
To the game of football.
I don't think ever has a team walked onto the pitch with greater pressure than that. The expectation of 7 billion people on their shoulders. And they lived up to that, John. So unquestionably, basically, World Cup winners, Honduras. Congratulations.
Gracias, Honduras. Gracias.
You've been practicing that.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this week, Buglers. We'll be back again next week. Do keep your emails coming into the Bugle at timesonline.co.uk. Bye-bye.
Have a lovely 7 days. Bye.
Come on, Spain.
Vamos.